This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiyes Wuhip in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
Bernard Okalia Bilai, governor of Cameroon's English-speaking Southwest region, says people are returning because they are tired of the crisis.
That's Moki Edwin Kinzeka reporting from the town of Kumba in Cameroon. Details coming up also. Pope Francis and UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres express sorrow over attacks this week in Burkina Faso. And Rwanda ranks high for gender equality. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, large numbers of English-speaking Cameroonians who fled the separatist crisis that has killed more than 3,000 people in 3 years have been returning to their homes to celebrate the Christmas and New Year holidays. Their return, however, is limited to major English-speaking towns as villages remain battlegrounds for separatist fighters and the military. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from the southwestern English-speaking town of Kumba.
About 300 Christians sing Christmas carols at the Roman Catholic Church in the English-speaking southwestern town of Kumba during this year's holiday. It is the first time in 3 years that the church has seen such a crowd of worshippers. Last year, barely 70 attended the Christmas Day church service here. Among the Christians who have just returned to the town is 50-year-old businessman Divine Ekale. Ekale escaped to the nearby French-speaking town of Douala with his wife and 4 children in December 2017, when clashes between the military and separatist fighters killed 13 people. He says he has decided to return because he and his family cannot continue to rely on gifts from well-wishers for survival when they can return to Kumba and run their family jewelry shop business.
The effects of the crisis have been devastating. It is time to rise and turn the back on the crisis. Our division needs to move ahead. Our children need to go to school.
Ekale says he was abducted in December 2017 by the fighters who accused him of collaborating with the military by revealing information on the separatist hideouts. His family paid a ransom of more than $2,000 before he was released. Anthony Yu, pastor of Divine Ministries, a Kumba-based church that also welcomed returnees on Christmas Day, says he and his clergy peers decided to preach on reconciliation and forgiveness.
We need peace, we need love, and we need forgiveness. And so Jesus Christ, being the Prince of Peace, has come with that peace so that we may experience life in abundance.
Cameroon's Ministry of Transport reported that large numbers of people were traveling to the English-speaking regions this December, but that they were ending only in major towns like Bamenda, Kumbu, Ndop, and Kambe in the northwest region, and Limbe, Boya, Kumba, Mamfe, Motengene, and Tiko in the southwest region. It did not give details on how many people had returned. Peter Njume, a lawmaker from the English-speaking southwest region, says most people are refusing to go to villages occupied by separatist fighters. He says civilians fear being caught in fighting between the military and the separatists. Njumi says some civilians who have been very vocal in the media advocating for separatists to drop their guns and surrender cannot return to their villages where they may be attacked by the fighters.
I am a target. I won't want a military to come around my compound and be living there while the other people are staying without the security that I will have.
Bernard Okalia Bilai, governor of Cameroon's English-speaking southwest region, says people are returning because they are tired of the crisis, which has lasted close to 3 years. He says the military has also made huge gains in restoring peace to most affected towns and villages. Bilai says people should not be afraid of going to any parts of the English-speaking regions.
Everything is ready to welcome them. They should not be afraid. Many stakeholders join us, the politicians, the elite, the religious leaders, welcome them. And with the support of the government, the security measure is reinforced by the entire population. The population has said enough is enough.
But most of the villages are either completely razed by the fighting or abandoned and need to be rehabilitated. Others host separatists who have fled from towns. Separatists launched attacks on government troops in 2017, stating that they wanted to create an English-speaking state in the English-speaking northwest and southwest regions of the country. They complained of an overbearing influence of the French-speaking majority. The government organized what it called a grand national dialogue from September 30 to October 4 to solve the crisis. Bilai claimed the massive return of civilians was because they were happy with the outcome of the dialogue that proposed a special status for the two English-speaking regions with elected presidents and vice presidents and additional powers to mayors. Separatists rejected the proposed special status, saying they want nothing but an independent state. The United Nations reports the crisis has killed at least 3,000 people and displaced more than 500,000 others, with about 50,000 as refugees in the neighboring Nigeria. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Kumba, southwestern Cameroon.
Pope Francis and UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres have expressed sorrow over the attacks this week in Burkina Faso that killed more than 120 people. The country is observing a 48-hour mourning period in response to the Christmas Eve attacks. Burkina Faso's military chief says Islamist insurgents attacked a military base in the town of Arbinda. China has cemented its position as most African countries' biggest economic and political partner. It is a complex and nuanced relationship. This week we are presenting a series of reports by VOA's Darren Taylor in Johannesburg. Today we look at the growing number of Chinese-owned companies opening factories on the continent, making everything from cutlery to cars. A leading authority on China's economic influence says Chinese-driven manufacturing is heralding a new dawn of poverty-busting industrialization in Africa. But critics fear China wants to plunder the continent's assets and resources.
Workers set machines to crush rocks at a cement factory in rural South Africa. The owner moved here from China several years ago.
Costs have been rising in China, labor costs, energy costs. And so factories are looking for locations overseas with lower costs. And one of those locations that Chinese industry has looked at is Africa.
Irene Yuen Sun is an expert in China-Africa economic relations at the Center for Global Development in Washington, D.C. While working for the McKinsey International Consulting Company, Sun led the most definitive study yet into Chinese business in Africa.
At that point, at a minimum, very conservatively, there were at least 10,000 Chinese businesses operating in sub-Saharan Africa. About a third of those are manufacturers. That's the biggest group. You get 15 to 20% chunks Chinese businesses that are in services, in trade, import-export, and in construction.
Massive blue and green computerized machines lift multicolored fabric between balloon-sized balls of white polyester at a pillow factory near Johannesburg. Peter Dan is the Chinese owner of this company.
55 million pieces need every year. So it's a huge market. It's only South Africa. And our target is not only South Africa, also include the neighbor countries, Zimbabwe, Botswana. And also in the future, maybe after 3 years, we're going to export to the Europe.
A researcher at South Africa's Institute of Security Studies, Stella Kwasi, says China's production expansion in Africa could spark the industrialization the continent needs, but at a high cost. She points out that some African governments offer incentives, such as subsidies, to Chinese investors.
That's like a pretty easy entry for a Chinese investor who already has the capital, and their government also funds these things. They have access to credit.
She says the African administrations that are so eager to attract Chinese money do little to support domestic entrepreneurs who struggle to get loans. Kwasi adds that even if African business people get funding, they can't compete with the technology that allows the Chinese to produce goods on a much larger scale, and thus more cheaply. She also maintains that relatively few local businesses benefit from China's huge infrastructure projects in Africa.
China literally imports everything. They get contracts to, say, construct roads. All the equipment comes from China. All the cement comes from China.
Kwasi says China essentially exports its surplus steel and cement to Africa. And when its factories producing these materials shut down because of oversupply at home, Beijing relocates them to Africa, where they're able to operate more easily than anywhere else because Africa's labor and environmental laws are weak. Kwasi thinks some African leaders know that China exploits the continent, but may allow it because they stand to benefit.
Chinese do not just come to Africa. Someone gets them in. That's our leadership. That's our governing elite. So what kind of regulations, what kind of leadership do we have?
And some African administrations, she says, see a political benefit from the backing of a great power like China.
Chinese investment and whatever Chinese activity is taking place in Africa entrenches the various forms of government or regime types that we have in Africa. Chinese do not ask questions, and African leaders do not like to be asked questions.
Kwasi urges Africans to look beyond the silver lining of China turning their continent into the world's next factory, and to continue asking their governments questions while demanding answers about the costs that this involves. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
The 2020 Gender Gap Report from the World Economic Forum ranks Rwanda 9th globally in promoting equality for women. Recently, Rwandan President Paul Kagame said he wants to be replaced by a woman when his tenure ends in 2024 to keep fostering gender parity. Eugene Wimana has more from Kigali.
The report puts Rwanda between Spain at 8th place and Germany in the 10th spot in promoting women worldwide. No other African nation is in the top 10. Rwanda's government has made steady efforts to make women's voices heard. Paul Kagame is the country's president.
The fight for gender equality is really common sense. Women are our mothers, sisters, and wives, and daughters. Whatever women gain, everybody gains and nobody loses.
However, many gender activists say there is still a long way to go to protect and promote women. Olivo Maria is a gender activist working with the organization CARE International.
We know that there are so many women who are living in violence, women who don't have access to the opportunities that are out there, and simply because they don't have the capacities, the power within, to understand that you have the voice, you matter, it can be possible.
In Rwanda's national dialogue, which concluded last Friday, Kagame endorsed the idea of a woman leading the country. Kagame says he wishes at the end of his tenure, his position can be taken by women. He says he hopes that is what men here want to. The World Economic Forum reports that in the past 50 years, 85 states have had no female head of state, and it says in terms of economic participation, the gender gap will take 257 years to close. According to the report, there are 72 countries where women are barred from opening bank accounts or obtaining credit. For Akinwumi Adesina, president of the African Development Bank, this is an issue that they are tackling.
A world that denies women the opportunities to excel is not a smart world. A world led by women will never have wars. Life bearers will never become life takers.
According to the World Economic Forum, it will take 95 years at the current rate to close the worldwide gender gap in political representation. The journey should not be that long for Rwanda. Today, women hold more than half of Rwanda's ministerial positions and more than 60% of the seats in the parliament. Four of seven Supreme Court judges are women. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
A coalition of Botswana opposition parties has lost its bid to have some results of the country's recent general election overturned. The opposition coalition had argued in court there were irregularities in the conduct of the October election, which the ruling Botswana Democratic Party won. The coalition is considering an appeal. From Habrone, Botswana, Mukandisi Dube reports.
The opposition coalition Umbrella for Democratic Change, UDC, had asked the court to nullify results in 16 parliamentary constituencies. The ruling Botswana Democratic Party won the October 23 general election, bagging 38 of the 57 National Assembly seats, while the UDC got 15. Smaller opposition parties won the remaining seats. But the UDC refused to accept the results, citing irregularities, including allegations of double voting by BDP supporters. However, this week, the High Court in Habrone ruled the petitions challenging the results were not properly filed. It was a split decision, with two of the three judges ruling in favor of the BDP. Justice Mercy Haworegui said the petitions were dismissed due to a technicality as they did not comply with certain regulations.
Whereas there is no time limit in prosecuting action proceedings in the ordinary course, there is a restriction in respect of petitions in that all processes have to be completed and a decision rendered within a period of 90 days. In the result, all the petitions are a nullity and are hereby set aside with costs to the first respondent.
But Justice Michael Liburu argued to the validity of the opposition's claims should have been tested through a trial.
In terms of the electoral rules, the question is the usage of the High Court rules reasonably necessary to enable the High Court to adjudicate electoral disputes? The answer, in my view, is in the affirmative. I hold that failure to serve a written notice of presentation of the petitions only is not fatal to the said petitions. Consequently, it is in the interest of justice that the troubling issues raised in the petition be referred to trial in order to test the veracity or otherwise of the said allegations.
UTC Vice President Dumelang Salishando said they are still analyzing this week's ruling with a view toward an appeal. The opposition said by dismissing the petitions through a technicality without going to trial, the court had denied the nation an opportunity to know the truth. But the BDP lawyer, Basimani Bahope, welcomed the ruling and said it was key that there is compliance when filing petitions. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Habrone, Botswana.
Basketball originated in the U.S., but increasingly it's a game Africa and much of the world has come to love. Since 2010, the U.S. National Basketball Association has been developing the Basketball Africa League on the continent. Its first pro season starts in the next few months. For years, the NBA has also conducted grassroots basketball programs for young people. It's a way to develop a fan base, offer team sportsmanship for kids, and provide some of them with a path to a future with the game both on and off the court. The New African League was in New York recently to showcase some of its talent. That's where VOA's Adam Phillips interviewed Don Smythe, the NBA's international grassroots lead in Africa. Smythe began by explaining what she loves about her job.
my passion around it, impacting people's first kind of few touches with the game, whether it's a player, a fan, an adult league, you know, pick up a ball, go outside. That's what we try to do to grow the game, to provide opportunities for those to play, but also to continue with the love of basketball.
You say get them involved, but how do you get them involved? I'm thinking especially of young ones who might otherwise be drawn foursquare into the world of football, or soccer as we call it here in the U.S.
So we've got sort of a list of junior MBA programs that are designed to fit for the region, because again, with so much diversity in the world, you want to make sure that you're bringing basketball to how it fits with the people that are in the country. And so in Africa, I've got leagues throughout Africa, and so it's starting to create some initial competition structure for the young kids. So under 18, under 16, under 14, for them to get into competition and play. A kid with their school will join into a junior NBA league, and they'll play against other schools locally. We often do drafts at the beginning. Sometimes, depending on the region, we'll put it like a skills competition in there where they get to try, you know, five different skills, and take some of those skills competitions and go to their own courts and practice that. You know, it's competing against yourself. Like when they see the competition again next year, it's like, have I improved? And then, you know, it kind of finishes it with the finals. So it mimics a full NBA season. So they're great fans in the NBA games, but then also to get to experience the game as a player.
It's very interesting balance from the NBA's point of view. On the one hand, you want to encourage a love of basketball in Africa. It's good to develop fans for business purposes, market development, etc. It's not that these kids are losers if they don't make it into the NBA or the BAL. But at the same time, you do want to identify and develop great talent at the grassroots, possibly for the real big time. What's your view of that?
You know, we've got a great department that does talent identification. And I think the one thing about talent is it shows up along a pathway. So it's not like 9-year-olds is the time that you have to be identified. You could actually be identified later. Like late developers tend to get picked up a little bit later in their pathway. So, you know, you want to make sure there's a place for everyone to play until they're identified. And when they stop playing, and if they're not identified, that there's so many different places in sport administration or the game itself, like refereeing and coaching and league organizers, that there's so many places for people outside of the 1% that move on to like a pro career or an NBA career.
I know the newly created Basketball Africa League is a big part of all this for the NBA, both as a place for talent as well as for some great careers off the court.
Yeah, great question. Two things. One, I think with the Ball League, it's obviously extremely exciting. I think it creates role models for these youth in the leagues. You know, where can I go? What can I do? So they can see their own pathway and their own future, and it's so impactful. But as we're building competition, it's equally important to build coaching education and referee education. We never want the athletes to get so good that the coaches don't have the technical knowledge and don't have the education to support their development, and that the referees continue to grow and we support them such that they can referee the competition. So there's lots of room for everybody.
You sound so excited. Tell me, what's your biggest gratification in all this? I mean, like, what has turned you on about it?
For me, I love the different cultures coming together under the one game. So I think it's like everyone's got different languages, different cultures day to day. However, when you bring the basketball out, everyone does the same dribbling, everyone does the same shooting. And so it becomes like a language of basketball, a culture of basketball. And so what's really cool in this position is working with the globe, the world, speaking and communicating and being about this one culture and the one language while embracing everybody's individuality. And so, like, for me, it's got to be one of the coolest things.
That was Don Smythe, the international grassroots lead for the National Basketball Association. She spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Joe Gill, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
My name is Larry London. Tune in on January 3rd at 1500 Universal for an interesting program on border crossings featuring the songs with time in the title. It's the new year, 2020 is here. And we'll be playing songs from Michael Jackson, Ariana Grande, Justin Bieber, all the hits with the word time in the title. See you at 1500 Universal on January 3rd, right here on Border Crossing.